It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know what gets overlooked at this time of year when it's all about Cracker Jack new menus and cookbook gifts? The not-so-new cookbooks. For instance, I was reading the Winter Solstice menu in the book Tom Douglas's Big Dinners. It has a caramelized fennel tart. I was practically panting. So I've done my own short list of favorite books gone by from the likes of Tom and Marcus Samuelson and Mario Batali and Nigella Lawson. And they're going to be up on the website. Now, besides that, you should stay with us. We've got great eats, gifts, and your calls this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today we're in full celebration mode. For our homemade gifts, we're off to England for treats not often seen in these woods. We hear about a wine that could take on nearly anything you're eating this season. Then baker Christina Tozzi joins us. Now, when you talk about out-of-the-box baking ideas, she's actually pulled together an entire book on them. She's the quirky mind behind New York's Momofuku Milk Bar. And speaking of quirky minds, John Moe joins us. Now, John's the host and head writer for American Public Media's new comedy variety show, Wits. And more importantly, he's a man who eats. And besides that, John has some great ideas for the techie types on your list. John, good to have you with us.
Hey, Lynn.
What's your criteria when you start looking at apps?
Well, you know, I like to eat. I don't like to think too much when I'm cooking. And I lack a lot of imagination. I'm not one of those who can see a pantry full of food and know exactly what dish it would go into. I don't really know. So I like sites and apps that help me along the way, that can take me from ingredients to a meal. And I like things that I don't have to spend a lot of time figuring out. Because if I'm looking up something on an app, it's not in the living room. It's not at bedtime. Mm-hmm. It's in the kitchen, and my family's hungry, and I got to get something together.
So you want to go from point A to point Z very, very quickly.
Yes, point A to point eat.
So I've got my computer set up here. You've got your smartphone right here. So what is your first find?
Well, I wanted to talk about The Professional Chef, and this is a $50 app, Lynn. It's the most expensive cooking app, but this is the textbook that all students at the Culinary Institute of America will use starting next year. They are going to go to an iPad textbook, and it is available for everybody. This is a great gift for the hardcore foodie on your list, and it is exhaustive. They have chapters and chapters about, you know, how to prepare meat before you ever cook it. They have extensive videos. They have gorgeous pictures. And if you're really into this, it's how the pros are learning to cook, and you could learn that way too. So when you think about tuition at a cooking school versus $50, suddenly it's a bargain.
And tuition at the Culinary Institute of America runs, I think, something like $25,000 or $30,000 a year. So
I'm not saying this is a substitute. I mean, there's still the sound of the onions in the pan. Can't replicate that.
Right. Okay, let's move on. What's your next find?
The next one is Big Oven. And talking about having an extensive back catalog of recipes here, this is an app that is free on my phone right here in front of us.
And let me see.
Yeah, it boasts 170,000 recipes.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right.
And again, there's something of an arms race when it comes to apps and it comes to websites. You know, we have 5 trillion recipes and you're not ever going to use them all.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm not so much interested in the arms race, but it's nice to know that it's there. It has a lot you can draw from.
Well, it has one thing here, recent raves.
It has recent raves. It has comments from users of the app, and it's a popular app. So people who've tried the recipes suggested what they think, kind of the customer reviews. I'll show you what I think is sort of my favorite of this thing. Here we have the use up leftovers option. Okay. So I'm going to say, look, I've got some corn around the house and I've got some potatoes.
Right.
I search on that. All of a sudden, here is an endless stream.
Of recipes.
You know, there's some corn chowder. There's some potato crusted salmon.
And the recipes are vetted because you have the comments of the people who say,
yes.
Yes, no, maybe. And
I tried
stars.
This. It didn't
yeah,
work.
Exactly.
And then it also has random recipe, which is really fun. Cheese scones. You know, it's drawing the name out of a hat. Again, I like this because it's a nice interface. It's easy to use. And it's got the big back catalog.
How about something non-cooking?
Okay, it's time to talk about food spotting. And this isn't about cooking, this is about eating. It will ask you when you install it, is it okay to report where you are? And you get a little bit of the privacy heebie-jeebies there, but go ahead and say yes.
Okay.
Because then it'll tell you, here are the foods nearby you. So right now I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it's going to tell me what is available. And it'll give me a picture of a spicy tuna roll at a place down the street. Or it'll just tell you sort of all foods that are nearby. You can search by, here's pizzas, burgers, seafood.
Is it
soup.
Critics' reports that they're basing it on?
This is social networking. This is the Facebook of going out to eat. And that's what's so fun about it. People are going out. They're ordering something. They're taking a picture of it. They're uploading it to food spotting. So here is a chili lime with tomato soup. Here is a ramen noodles at one of my favorite Japanese places here in town. And it's just a simple shot. You get your food, you take a picture, you upload it to food spotting. Then usually the person who eats it and takes the picture will give you a little review as well. And so it's one of these things like, I'm kind of hungry. Let's see what's nearby. It's sort of the app equivalent of when you're at a restaurant and the waiter comes by with something really good for somebody else. And you say, ooh, I want to get that. Isn't very good, though, at, you know, I was trying out, like, let's say I went to New York and I was staying in Midtown. What am I going to want to eat once I get there?
Mm-hmm.
It's not so good at that. It's really an of-the-moment kind of app. It really takes into
account. I'm here now.
Right. I am hungry. It's lunchtime. Where can I go? Food spotting. It's a lot of fun.
And it's free. A magical word.
and it's nice, too, because it's not necessarily the pictures that they would put on a website, the restaurant would. It's what people found, what it actually looks like when you order it. And sometimes it's gorgeous and sometimes it's a little suspect.
Yeah. And also it's the instant review, which I think is really interesting.
Yes.
From the restaurant's point of view as well as from our points of view.
Right.
John, thank you.
Sure.
John Moe is the host and head writer for American Public Media's new comedy variety show, Wits. Now, find his tech picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Christina Tozzi runs one of the breakout bakeries in New York City, Momofuku Milk Bar. Now, you go there to taste saltine panna cotta, fruity pebbles, Christmas cookies, and an apple pie cake people rave over. Well, she's done a book, and she's put all that imagination in print, along with a solid basic primer for beginning bakers. The book is Milk, Momofuku Milk Bar. And Christina joins us from New York City. Hey, Christina, welcome to the show.
Hey. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you here. So, okay, my first question is this. Are you working for General Mills?
No. No, just for the Momofuku Milk Bar Empire.
Yeah, but, you know, it's so funny, though. I go through the book. Your imagination is just amazing, and I see the Captain Crunch and the fruity pebbles and the oval tea.
Yeah, it makes you want to laugh. I mean, I think for me, those are just the things that I love. They're the things that sort of satisfy my soul and soothe me. And so, you know, I take that passion for baking and I tend to go for those ingredients that sort of speak to me with that same sort of like soulful passion. And it happens to be cereal and Ovaltine milk.
But you were classically trained, right, as a chef?
Yeah. I went to I actually moved to New York about 10 years ago to attend the French Culinary Institute's pastry arts program because I wanted to be classically trained. I really thought I was going to be sort of like a very fancy, classically trained pastry chef that made, you know, large sugar sculptures and large, you know, tempered chocolate decorative art pieces. And I sort of ended up not turning my back on my formal training, but taking nods to it and taking pieces in terms of technique and just presenting it in a very casual way. Because for me, there's nothing better than a warm out of the oven cookie. And, you know, I would choose that any day over sort of like a warm chocolate souffle with a magnificent tuile and rose petal
and
ice
all that
cream.
Stuff. Yeah. You know, I must say, when I look at a recipe for pretzel ice cream pie, you know, or the chocolate cake with the Ovaltine soak and you've got a burnt marshmallow frosting, that really can do it for you. But you've got this solid baking background, but you're using really unusual ingredients. You know, I've done a lot of baking. I've never seen some of these things. For instance, okay, milk crumb. What is milk crumb?
So in working in these very fancy pastry kitchens, one thing that was sort of always a staple was this thing that they're in pastry kitchens they're calling crumbs. Sometimes they're also called soils. And they're sort of like this crummy, sandy bit of flavor that you put on the plate to sort of hold your ice cream in place or create a little bit more texture.
So you're talking about the regular powdered milk that we can buy in any supermarket?
Absolutely. It's the milk powder you get in like the powdered drink aisle. But we use it sort of as a flavoring ingredient. And I sort of joke even that it's sort of what I like to refer to as the MSG for pastry chefs, because we not only make these little crummy textural elements called milk crumbs with the milk powder, but we'll also use milk powder in recipes to sort of just deepen the flavor because it gives it a better bottom line flavor. It gives it a little bit of a texture, a little chewiness, a little crunch.
It's a great thing.
So it's for any sort of crumb, whether it's a milk crumb or another flavor, you start out with flour, sugar, salt. We use a powdered flavor. So in milk crumbs, it's just the milk powder. If you wanted to make chocolate crumbs, it would be chocolate powder and so on. We melt some butter and we stir it in, and it's just enough butter to flour to sort of get this sort of streusel-like texture where it's enough to sort of bind those dry ingredients together, but it still keeps them rather rocky in texture. So we toast them in the oven just a little, and then I toss them with a little extra white chocolate because for me, it gives it a little bit more of that idealized version of what milk should taste like. It's milky, it's sweet. There's something about a little note of white chocolate that really brings the milk crumb of it to life. And that's it.
And that's
we put it.
And then
in cookies, we layer it in cakes for texture. You can press it into a pie crust. It's very versatile.
Okay. The other thing you do, which is really intriguing, is your work with cereal. Tell me about this.
For me, you know, drinking milk was a requirement as a child. So the sort of carte blanche that I had as a kid was that I could ask to buy any box of cereal in the grocery store because it was always a guarantee that I would be drinking my milk because I would eat the cereal first and then, of course, I would drink the milk afterwards. So I think, you know, sort of being a picky eater and being sort of exploiting my mom on that channel, I really grew to love cereal on a whole nother level than just your average, you know, a bowl for breakfast. I'd eat it for lunch. I'd eat it for dinner. So when I was sort of deciding what my personality would be as a pastry chef, I just tried to take as many notes in terms of who I was as a person, what my palate was, and honestly not being afraid to be like, it's cornflakes, it's Captain Crunch, it's Fruity Pebbles, and I'm going to try and be as thoughtful and technique-driven as possible with it, and I'm going to see how far I can push it. So it gives that playful note. It gives a great flavor that everybody knows and loves.
Mm-hmm. Christina, happy holidays, and thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much. Happy holidays to you.
Christina Tozzi is author of Milk, Momofuku Milk Bar. Now, you can find her recipe for cornflake chocolate chip marshmallow cookies with her holiday variations on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, spend a little time. Get registered for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Sign up for podcasts. Check out our holiday page and online stores. There's lots there. Just go to splendidtable.org. Now, we'll be back with homemade gift ideas from England and the one wine you may want to pour from now until the new year. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, getting ideas for homemade gifts can be challenging, but we found a book with a decidedly British take. It's Homemade Gifts from the Kitchen by the UK food writer Annie Rigg. Annie, welcome.
Great, thanks for having me.
So you were a rock and roll caterer.
Yes, I spent 3 years of my youth traveling with Paul McCartney, Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd. We went around the world 3 times. So picked up a few things along the way.
Sounds like a great way to misspend one's youth.
It's definitely a game for the young.
You know, this book has a lovely British bent to it. For instance, you've got a recipe for an Indian chutney in it. Tell us about that one.
Well, we do certainly like our curries in the UK. And I don't necessarily like the main part of the curry. I like the pickles and the breads and the poppadoms and all the bits and pieces that go with them. So I have 2 chutneys in the book. One is an aubergine chutney and one is a mango chutney. And I quite often give them as gifts together.
And how long will they keep?
They keep for about 3 months. They take a bit of time to sort of mature if they've got spices in them. But once they're opened, they should always be stored in the fridge, these kind of things.
Uh-huh. So let's talk about crackers, because I don't think people ever think about making homemade crackers.
Well, I always think about baking. And I particularly love cheese. And I think if you're going to serve or give a nice box of beautiful cheeses, why not make beautiful homemade crackers to go with it? And you nowadays can get so many different types of flour with grains and seeds in. And I think it just makes a really beautiful gift, a package of homemade oatmeal crackers and a beautiful bit of brie or a reblochon or something like that.
What's in the oatmeal crackers?
These ones they've got bran, and I use wholemeal flour, but I use wholemeal flour, which has got, as I say, lots of little bits of interest in there, maybe some barley flakes and some oat flakes, and a smidge of dried mustard powder, and then just salt, pepper, and butter and sugar, really. It's very easy. I mean, most people have those ingredients in their cupboards anyway, so it's a good gift to make as the last minute, sort of if you're invited to dinner or something.
How about the sweet side? What kinds of things do you like to do on the sweet side?
Oh, I love all sweet making. I love making candies, toffees, caramels, marshmallows, chocolate truffles, baking, and Turkish Delight as well. I make quite a lot of that.
What is Turkish Delight?
Turkish Delight is the rose water-scented jelly, which is sort of set with gelatin and then cut into cubes and tossed in powdered sugar.
Oh, I think I know what you mean. Yeah, and they're kind of chewy. They kind of melt in
slightly
your mouth.
Slightly chewy and unmistakably girly. I mean, they're very, very pink and light and delicious. They take a bit of practice, maybe sort of cutting them into the right size squares and cubes. They don't keep for too long, so it's best to make them and give them fairly quickly, but they're very easy to make.
How about a liqueur?
Well, I do quite a lot of fruit-flavoured alcohols, and particularly limoncello is a good one. I can't think of anyone that doesn't like limoncello. So it's a sort of lemon-infused vodka. And it's particularly nice if you prepare it as a gift, and maybe with some pretty shot glasses, and look out for a nice bottle and tie it all up as one great big package.
So what have you learned the hard way about doing your own homemade gifts?
I think the lesson I learned last year was don't give too much. I gave a number of hampers to people with sort of 6 or 7 different things in them, and they all came back saying, oh, it was wonderful, we had so much to eat, but we just couldn't get through it all, and we felt bad because we, you know, didn't have time to eat everything, because some things have a shorter shelf life than others, so you need to make sure that people know exactly how long something will keep for. So it always helps to write on the gift tag, maybe the storage instructions and how you would suggest serving something, how long it will keep. Just any information like that is always really helpful and makes a nice little touch, I think.
Yeah. Hey, Annie, thanks for the great ideas.
It's a pleasure.
And happy holidays.
And to you. Thank you.
Annie Rigg's book is Homemade Gifts from the Kitchen, and we've got her recipes for that Turkish delight, the brinjal pickle, and the limoncello, and they're all on the website, splendidtable.org.
Well, here's a wine and food pairing question for you. Which wine can you drink with all of these dishes? A bowl of Sichuan noodles, a delicate grilled fish, a Korean barbecue taco, and salty caramel ice cream? Well, the short answer is a white wine called Riesling. Here in the U.S., Riesling is a sleeper wine. But if you go to the mothership, Riesling's home, Germany, it's the jewel in the crown. Now, wine writer Stuart Piggott moved from the U.K. to Germany 2 decades ago to study wine, in particular, Riesling. His website is Planet Wine, and Stuart joins us from Germany. Stuart, welcome.
Thank you.
Stuart, how can a Riesling taste right with that whole range of flavors?
Well, Riesling is a wine which is light and refreshing, but very strong and intense. And it has an enormous range of nuance. You have wines ranging from the very dry to the very sweet, from the very light to the very powerful. Every possible combination of those things is possible.
Does any other grape have this ability?
I would love to find one. I think it would have considerable commercial potential.
And that's an interesting point, because at least in this country, we don't know that much about Riesling. I mean, the popularity of other wines and other grapes is huge, but Riesling is nowhere near as popular, and yet...
Well, in its quiet way, Riesling has been growing rather fast the last years, even if it doesn't make a big noise. And, you know, doesn't attract that many big headlines. It's a grassroots thing. People just bump into the wine and discover they like it and start discovering its enormous gastronomic potential.
Well, you know, how can you tell on the bottle how sweet the wine is going to be? Because I've had them where they're absolutely bone dry, and I've had them where they would be great with a salty caramel ice cream or a creme brulee. Is there a way of knowing on the bottle?
Yes, there is. Very, very often it says something like a dry or sweet on the label. And
oh, that's pretty obvious.
Yes,
yeah.
In recent years there is also been a small graphic which you can find on the back labels of many Rieslings, which tells you exactly what the level of sweetness of the wine is. And look at the alcoholic content. If the alcoholic content is 10% or lower, it's going to be a sweetish wine. The dry wines start around 11.
So now this is one of the great wines of Germany, right?
Of the world, I would say. A lot of very good Riesling is being made in America. It's just not that well known.
Well, okay. Where in America?
Well, for example, in the Finger Lakes in upstate New York, in the north of Michigan, in Washington State. I would say those are the three most important regions, but there's a bit of Riesling in a great many other places as well.
Now, I have to say, I knew about the Finger Lakes, and I know about the Northwest, but I didn't realize the peninsula of Michigan.
Yes, the Old Mission and Leelanau Peninsulas, close to Traverse City in the north of Michigan, produce some very fine Rieslings that are, yeah, beautiful, elegant, generally just off-dry wine.
Huh. Can you name some names for us?
Well, the biggest... They call themselves the biggest Riesling producer east of the Rockies. Chateau Grand Traverse is the most important producer up there.
I see. Now, what about German Rieslings? I realize this is like asking you to pick your favorite child, but some names for us to look for to have a good sense of what a German Riesling is about.
Well, if you want to get a sense of what is happening now, the new generation of Riesling producers who have been coming up since the turn of the century, then I think you really need to look for a dry wine from one of the leading young Turks. For example, from Philip Wittmann, that's written W-I-T-T-M-A-N-N, Wittmann. It's spoken rather like you would speak the name of Walt Whitman.
Right.
These are prototypic examples of what's new here in Germany. Philip Pittman is a role model for hundreds of wine growers who are even younger than he is.
What is the difference? I mean, what is so different?
Well, his wines manage to combine a considerable amount of body and power with this lightness of touch and this freshness, which is so characteristic for Riesling wines.
And what would you eat with something like this?
I think as long as the food is not terribly sweet or extremely spicy, you have an incredibly flexible wine there, which will go with a great deal of particularly lighter foods. But, if the steak isn't slathered in barbecue sauce, it's probably going to manage there pretty well, too.
A white wine with steak. Interesting.
No problem at all. People assume that we have so many fixed ideas, even I do in my mind, about which wine is going to go with which food. And when you try these things out, there's an awful lot of big surprises coming.
Well, Stuart, thank you. This is an interesting beginning for us to understand this wine.
I think we are really at the beginning of the age of Riesling.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Stuart Pigott's website is Planet Wine. Now, for his Riesling suggestions, go to our website, splendidtable.org. And to pair up with those wines, well, I'm thinking about the dish I always want to eat. Nearly any off-dry Riesling goes with Vietnamese spring rolls. Now, the thing to love about spring rolls is that you can roll up nearly any leftover you have in that rice paper. The trick is always to include fresh coriander or mint leaves and salad greens. I've got a basic recipe up on the website. You can find Homestyle Spring Rolls at splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern are the road food deities. These two know where to find places like that one gas station in the middle of nowhere with tamales to die for. They report in to their website, roadfood.com, and they stop by here. Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. Is there a city that you think is really kind of the queen or the king of great late night eating?
Absolutely, yes, there is. Except for us, it's more like extremely early morning eating. And it's Los Angeles. That's what we're talking about. And I know this because, you know, what happens is when Jane and I fly to Los Angeles, we're 3 hours ahead already. And normally we get up pretty early. So if we normally get up in the East at 6 a.m., that's 3 a.m. in Los Angeles. So we get up hungry for breakfast. Where do you go? Well, in L.A., there are a lot of really excellent choices. For one thing, if you arrive late at the airport, there is Randy's Donuts. Now, even if you don't know this place, you have seen it. I guarantee Randy's is marked by that gigantic donut on top of the roof.
Faux donut.
Well, it's not a real donut. You're right.
It's like, cement
donut. We kind of get that. Yeah, we kind of get that.
You never know. Yeah.
I've never seen a bite out of it. It's about 3 stories tall, and they're open all the time. They're right near the airport. And in fact, the donuts are pretty darn good there. I mean, they have donuts, they have cinnamon rolls, apple fritters, bear claws. They even have bagels, but there's something kind of sacrilegious, it seems to me, about having a bagel
at
a donut place.
Well, the best thing about Randy's is because it's always open, everything's fresh because, it's a tiny place and they just have to keep making the donuts right away.
Well, okay, if you've got the sugar high taken care of, but what about something more substantial?
You want some meat. Some eggs, like a real meal. Cantor's Deli. I mean, one of the classic Jewish delis in Los Angeles, open all the time. And, you can go there for anything from a simple plate of eggs to, giant pastrami sandwiches, corned beef. The last time we were there, I got some matzah brei, which is broken up matzah. With scrambled eggs. It was really good. And one of the things that's great about Cantor's is the bread itself, the rye bread. They don't actually bake it there. What they do is get loaves, that are sort of half-baked and then bake it there on premises. So when you order a sandwich on rye, it's absolutely fresh with that good glossy crust and that kind of real sourdough flavor to the rye, like dense, good rye bread. So, corned beef or pastrami or salami on that is heaven.
Yes. What about the coffee shops?
Well, it's funny. We had assumed that some of the classic coffee shops would be open. And the only one that is open all the time, and is a really great place to go if you're in L.A., it's a must, actually, is the Original Pantry, which has been open since 1924. It's famous for never once having closed its doors since 1924.
Really?
Yes. And the thing about it is it's kind of old-fashioned, too. I mean, it's not Jewish, it's not donuts, but, I mean, here you get, you know, really great bacon and eggs with sourdough toast, thick slabs of bacon, really good hash browns. The orange juice is freshly squeezed. The coffee keeps coming. And, you know, if you go there for and you want a serious meal, not breakfast, I mean, you get the roast beef, the liver and onions. And always, whether it's breakfast, lunch, or supper, you want for dessert hot apple pie with rum sauce. It's really good.
To me, coffee shops are the absolute classic late-night dining in L.A. I mean, the whole architecture and the whole mystique of the L.A. coffee shop, that is where I would want to roll in after a long night of doing something that I'm sure I never do, but theoretically.
and you know, Lynn, I think we recently did talk with you about Dupar's, which is in the Farmer's Market, another open all-night place where the pancakes, stacks of pancakes come with not only a pitcher of syrup, but also a pitcher of melted butter to pour over the stack. That's my kind of pancake.
Well, that's the most civilized touch.
Yes.
The butter. And you never know. I mean, you might be sitting next to who knows who, right?
You know, you really said something there because one of the fun things about going to the L.A. coffee shops, not coffee houses, is you do see celebrities. I mean, when they're not dining out in fancy private restaurants or clubs, it's a really democratic place. And I think Dupar's is really great for celebrity spotting.
As is Cantor's, curiously enough, and I don't really quite understand it, Cantor's has always been a very attractive place for real fringe rock and roll artists, maybe just because of the hours that it's open. But there are pictures all over the walls of people that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see in a typical Jewish deli.
Only in L.A. Guys.
Only in L.A.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern's site is roadfood.com. All right, it is time for the weekly trivia challenge. And the question is, what is beer doing for a hospital? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I will talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is beer doing for a hospital? Well, beer is supplying enough power to cover 10 to 13% of the electricity to run a hospital. The specifics are the City Brewery in La Crosse, Wisconsin, uses the biogas byproduct from its brewing process to create kilowatt hours. Now, they pass those hours on down the road to the Gunderson Lutheran Health System. They figure by 2014, all of the power used by that hospital will be covered by the reclaimed energy from City Brewery. Now, think about this. There are craft breweries all over the place. Do you see neighborhoods powered by six packs? Time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Friend us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Send us that email, splendidtable.org. We have Dirk calling us from Springfield, Missouri. Dirk, what is on your mind, sir?
Well, Lynn, Me and my friend Tim, we hold our own Christmas dunce every year.
Christmas dunce?
Yeah.
What's a Christmas dunce?
Well, we are both from Finnish heritage.
Yes.
And it is just sort of our form of a Christmas party, but the life of the party has to be the Yule log.
That is a great idea. You mean you're going to make your own Yule log?
Yes. Every year we make our own Yule log, and it's sort of become a competition. Every year the next person tries to make the bigger and the better Yule log.
Uh-oh. I see trouble coming right now. So what is the question, Dirk?
So I was wondering what I could use to spice up my Yule log, to add a little bit of surprise to my Yule log. I've made chocolate ones. I've made eggnog ones. But I want one that has a little bit of oomph to it.
What if your Yule log was on fire?
Whoa.
No, this is what I'm thinking. Stay with me on this. This is really a little much. But have you ever made meringue mushrooms?
No, I actually have not.
Well, all right, we've got two choices here. Number one, you can make a Yule log that's covered as though it were discovered in the forest with meringue mushrooms all over it. And that's really great fun, and it just looks like something out of Walt Disney. But what might be fun is to make meringue flames. And what you do is you make your Yule log, right? But what you have is standing up from it, and you can kind of sprinkle them with red and orange glittery sprinkles that you might normally put on cookies.
Yeah.
This will be garish as all get out. Let me explain how you would go about doing either the meringue mushrooms or the flames.
Okay.
You would make a meringue. Have you ever made meringue? Okay, so you know you beat egg whites with sugar, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you load up a pastry bag, and the pastry bag has a tip on it that just is a plain round tip. It doesn't have any serrations or anything like that.
Okay.
And to make the mushrooms, you put some parchment paper on a cookie sheet, your oven at maybe 200 degrees, okay, really low.
Okay.
And what you do is you hold the pastry bag absolutely perpendicular to the cookie sheet, and to make the stems of the mushrooms, you make a sort of, you know, you let the pastry bag sit there for a moment so you have a bit of a wide, flat bottom of the stem, and then you lift it. And you can make different size stems. But
that
as you lift
genius.
It, as you lift it, you get this sort of little column with a peak at the top.
Yeah.
To make the caps, and you make all different size ones is – you lower it to within a quarter inch or a half inch of the pan.
Yeah.
And you squeeze. So you get this
simple
spreading mushroom top. And then when you lift it, you get a little peak. So with a dampened finger, you smooth the peak. And then you bake it until it's dry. You can sprinkle a little cocoa on top because that's maybe some of the little bit of soil, you know, in the forest.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
Right? Some you do, some you don't. You want variety. And you can do a ton of these, and you do them in all different sizes. And you bake them, and then you let them dry overnight in the oven. And then to put them together, you take melted chocolate and you put it at the bottom of the mushroom cap so it looks like the black gills.
Oh,
and
my
goodness. You glue with the chocolate the stem into the cap. This is tedious work. It will drive you crazy. Do it with friends.
It is totally going to kick Tim's dunce butt, though.
So you march those all over your Yule log and out, you know, and I put frosting on the platter and I have them, you know, out onto the forest floor. Now, to make the flames, just pipe out onto the sheet wiggly long lines that end in peaks that look like flames of all different sizes, and sprinkle them with that different flame-colored, you know, glittery things you would put on the Christmas cookies. And those will bake. They'll be flat, but you'll kind of match them together, and you'll stick those on top of the Yule log. And you'll frost the Yule log with a darker frosting, but then you'll cover it with some powdered sugar to look like ash.
That is going to be so
That's going to be freaky looking. It's going to be a little bit more happy hands at home looking.
It's going to be the life of the party, though, Lynn.
I think this is going to be a hoot. Dirk, have a wonderful dunce party.
Hey, you too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Those meringue mushrooms, by the way, those meringue mushrooms are so easy to make, and you can do little tiny baskets. Don't try to do large ones because you will lose your mind. But they're great things to bring as a little gift or just to give kids. Because kids just love them. They're magical. They're just magical. Jamie is calling from Phoenix. Jamie, what are you thinking about?
I am thinking about an Italian dinner party. My friends and I have this wonderful tradition of getting together around the holidays and cooking enormous amounts of delicious food and stuffing ourselves. And the thing is, all of my Italian dishes that I have are usually fish, and they're kind of summery.
Right.
And I have a lot of people who are coming who don't like fish or seafood at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could help me think of some really great, hearty, delicious winter Italian dishes.
Oh, boy. Oh, let me count the ways. Okay, let's see. Well, you know, there is a dish that comes to mind, and it's hearty and it's delicious. And, well, let me ask you this. First of all, let's get some parameters before I sail here. What kind of gathering are you thinking of? Is it like a sit-down dinner, and do you want to do courses? Is it going to be a buffet where you want to do everything ahead and you put out all the food and everybody helps themselves?
It's kind of a buffet, and everyone fills up their plates as much as they can, and then we just sit down and we enjoy.
All right. I think one of the things that you want to do is, of course, you've got to have a pasta dish.
Mm-hmm.
And ideally, it should be a dish that is a baked pasta dish because, you know, great pasta dishes that you know, you toss in the pan and that kind of thing really have to be made the last minute. But baked pasta dishes are incredibly forgiving. And I think what you want to make maybe for people who are meat lovers and love kind of deep, lush tastes, I want you to make a classic lasagna a la bolognese.
Ooh, yeah. That just sounds delicious.
Well, it is utterly delicious. And you have two choices here, in fact. You can do a classic lasagna bolognese. Now, this is with the classic bolognese meat sauce. Now, this is a meat sauce without a lot of tomato in it.
That's good.
And it's layered between very thin pasta with layers of a cream sauce between.
Ooh, yum.
All right, that's one version. The other choice you have in your lasagna is one they will have never seen or heard of before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from our new book, but it has been around since maybe the 1400s. And it's a Renaissance lasagna. And this is a lasagna that's done with chicken, and it has cinnamon in it. And it has raisins, and
Ooh.
It has herbs, and you layer that with very delicate noodles, and then you have cream and Parmigiano, and it is the most fabulous thing you have ever eaten. And it takes time, but you can make the sauce ahead. You can do it all ahead, and then you bake it off.
Oh, that just sounds really good. All those spices and cinnamon and raisin just screams winter.
Just absolutely glorious. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this recipe up on the website. It's just simply called Renaissance Lasagna.
Perfect.
And it's from the Emilia-Romagna region, and it is just a killer, killer recipe. Now, with that, what would be beautiful to do with that is I would do a very simple salad with the dressing on the side. I would get some, you know, curly endive, tart winter greens, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And get yourself a little bit of candied lemon rind.
Ooh, yum.
Okay? And then get yourself some pine nuts or pistachio nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd mix that with the greens, and then on the side you would have a dressing simply of balsamic vinegar, good olive oil, and a little bit of wine vinegar. And people would just take that salad and drizzle the dressing as they go, because otherwise it'll wilt.
Yeah.
And then the other things you want out are, for an antipasto for people to nibble, are some good salami, you know, olives,
mm-hmm.
the typical things you would think of as being Italian. And then I would have green beans that you have dressed with little bits of mortadella or salami that you've
Ooh.
Tossed, and you've sautéed them in olive oil with some nuts, you know, like salted almonds.
Yeah.
And you just put that out and let them sit until they get to room temperature. There's no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
So that lasagna becomes the whole centerpiece.
Oh, that just sounds really good.
Oh, it's delicious.
I can't wait to try
it. It's delicious. You're going to love it. So I'm going to put up on the website, okay? It's just called simply a Renaissance lasagna.
Perfect.
And the other parts of it, you know, you can put together. It's not a big
deal. Yeah, throw it together.
Okay? All right?
Okay.
And
thank you so much.
You are welcome. And you can have a great party.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Sarah Wu teaches speech at a grammar school in Chicago, and she always brings her lunch. Well, one day she didn't. Instead, she went to the school cafeteria for a student lunch. And what followed became a year of blogging and now a book. It's called Fed Up with Lunch,
how one anonymous teacher revealed the truth about school lunches and how we can change them. Sarah, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So that first lunch, tell me what happened.
I forgot my lunch and went down to the cafeteria and paid $3 for what was a bagel dog, a few tater tots, and a fruit cup. And I just couldn't believe what I saw on my tray. I was pretty disappointed in the food because a lot of my students really rely on the school for their best meal of the day. And I had gone through the cafeteria before, but I hadn't really been paying attention, and so it was a big wake-up call for me.
So what did you do?
So I thought about what I could do, and I figured there was really very little because I thought I could talk to my manager, the principal, and I didn't see that going anywhere, and even registering a complaint downtown, I didn't think that that might yield very much. So I knew a little bit about blogging, and I thought, I could anonymously blog a year of school lunches and really feel like I was making a public record of the meals, and I decided I would eat them and blog my way through a full calendar year. So when school started up again in January 2010, I just bought school lunch.
People obviously started noticing the blog.
Oh, yeah. I thought I'd put this out there, and then maybe in 3 to 4 months, I might get a couple comments. And then just after eating 2 weeks of school lunches, I started getting a ton of comments. I remember when I got 20 comments, I couldn't believe it. And I pretty much freaked out because I was doing this anonymously. I didn't want to jeopardize my job. And for me, it was sort of total elation followed by complete panic. Mm. And so I lived in fear. I just hoped that nobody would put two and two together because I started getting interview requests in February of 2010, and I started telling people, no, I'm sorry, I'm not available for interviews because I was terrified. But I finally decided that, you know, if I'm doing this as a passion for children and their health and wellness, I am going to start granting interviews. And that's when really people started taking notice of the blog.
And so you went out there.
I went out there. I went out there anonymously. But, yeah, I decided that it was worth it.
One of the things you seem to make a big point of is how much time the children have to eat lunch.
Yes. It's pretty appalling. It's 20 minutes for lunch, and that includes lining up and... When you work at a school like I do where there's 1,000 or even as high as 1,300 elementary school students and you're talking maybe dividing, you know, the lunch period by five, let's say there's five lunch periods, the kids are herded in lines just like cattle and have to quickly grab all the components of the meal, put them on their tray, and rush to sit down. And, you know, my colleagues and I were pretty disappointed by so much about the lunch experience, but one of the things that really bothered us was it boiled down to 9 to 13 minutes of actual eating time, and sometimes it was even less.
Well, Sarah, I hope this opens people's eyes, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for letting me share my story.
Sarah Wu is author of Fed Up with Lunch. Well, that's the show this week. Thanks for tuning in. And until next week, let me leave you with this from Irma Bombeck, who said, no self-respecting mother would run out of intimidations on the eve of a major holiday. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcasts, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest series, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. It's all waiting, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson.
Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.